Now, the 2016 election brought a new focus on facts, fact-checking, reliable sources, and the definition of a reliable source. But the science of how we respond to facts shows something that may or may not surprise you, even with facts. It's really hard to change somebody's mind.
Julie Beck wrote about that for The Atlantic, where she's senior associate editor. Julie, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, reading your article, I kept thinking of the Simon and Garfunkel song, The Boxer, the line, "A man hears what he wants to hear and disregards the rest." And it turns out that's kind of true. They were right. So why is it so hard to really hear facts that we disagree with?
Yeah, they got it pretty much exactly right. It's important to clarify is, like, people do change their minds all the time, right? Like, you know, you can encounter new evidence and you can change your mind and it's not a problem, usually. When it becomes a problem is when the facts that you're encountering suggest something that runs extremely counter to your worldview or your identity or groups that are really tied to your identity, because then to accept those facts would mean, like, radically reorienting yourself to the world, and people don't want to do that.
So one word for that reorienting is, the process that happens is cognitive dissonance, this idea that you're holding two conflicting ideas within your head at the same time, and it's apparently very unpleasant to have this. And there's a famous study that you write about, done back in the 60s, using recordings that had some static, some interference, and then the participants could decide whether they pushed a button and were able to hear things more clearly. And what happened was pretty telling about the way that we choose to zero in on things. What did it say?
Yeah. So, I mean, they had, you know, some undergrad students, as they do, listen to some speeches that had a lot of static in them. And so, for example, some of the speeches were about smoking. And so it was either, you know, said the truth, which is that smoking causes cancer, or it was arguing that smoking might not actually be linked to cancer after all. And they told the students, you know, oh, sorry, the recording's not amazing. Like, if you want to hear it better, you can press this button and it'll reduce the static for a few seconds. And what they found is that the students who were smokers were very eager to tune in to this speech that suggested that it might not be linked to cancer, whereas the non-smokers wanted to listen more to the one that did link it to cancer.
So what does that tell us? What's the takeaway?
I mean, so the process, you know, by which you kind of reduce your cognitive dissonance is motivated reasoning, and there's a lot of different things that you can do with that. You know, you can argue against the facts, you can say the evidence is weak, you can say, you know, the source that's telling them to you is, you know, not reliable. But, I mean, it starts really with what you even are willing to pay attention to. And so that study is a very sort of clear example of how people just don't even want to pay attention to the facts that are disagreeing with them. Like, they're just going to let it dissolve into static.
Right, so what happens when something is a core part of our identity and we come across something that runs contrary to that identity? Do we know in our brains or in the way that our psychology functions how we respond to that new information that comes head on against what we believe about ourselves?
I mean, I think the thing to sort of realize about false beliefs or false knowledge or whatever you want to call it, you know, things that you think are true that are not true, is that to you, it feels the same as the truth. Like, you don't understand that there is a difference between the, you know, beliefs that you hold that are based in facts and the beliefs that you hold that are based not in facts. They feel the same. And so when you encounter information that goes against them, whether it's you know, whether you believe something is true and it is true, and then you encounter some kind of crazy theory about it, you would obviously discount that. But you would do the same thing for something you believe that is based in not in truth at all, and then you encounter the truth. It feels the same.
We're talking with Julie Beck right now, senior associate editor at The Atlantic, and we're talking about, one word for it would be cognitive tribalism, or why it's so hard to change people's minds about something that they're very invested in or believe to be true. And Julie, how does the media play into this kind of thing?
Yeah, it is tricky. You know, people love to talk about the fake news, and I think that's not helping. But it just makes it a lot easier to sort of selectively expose yourself to the information that is agreeable to you and ignore the rest. And that's something that, you know, people have always been able to do in different ways. You know, you can turn off the TV, you can turn off the radio, you can read whatever newspapers agree with you. But obviously the internet does make it a lot easier for you to kind of cultivate the media environment that you find most comfortable.
And you write about supporters of Donald Trump who, in a study, are confronted with side-by-side pictures of Inauguration Day crowds at both Obama's inauguration and Trump's inauguration. And you also write about Democrats who support banning the chemical BPA despite what seems to be a consensus of research that small amounts of BPA are safe. What do we know about how this question about the veracity of these various pictures and the safeness of BPA is processed in people's brains? Do they hear it as a question of true or false, or do they hear it more like, you know, who do you support? Which side are you on?
Yeah, so each situation is kind of unique. I'll use the Trump photos as an example because I think there's something really important there with, you know, Trump's been all steamed up about how not as many people came to his inauguration, and the photos pretty clearly bear that out. In the study, you know, they showed the Trump supporters both photos, and they said which one is Trump's, and many of them said that the one with more people was Trump's. But what was interesting is when they explicitly told them which photo was Obama's and which one was Trump's, and they said which one has more people, they would say that Trump's had more people, even though it clearly doesn't. And so I think a lot of people, when reporting on this, have been sort of presenting it as like, oh, isn't this like amazing, like the depths of their self-deception, blah, blah, blah. But really, like, it's not quite that. You know, I think they knew what was being asked of them. And the question, sort of behind the question of whose photo is whose, was whose team are you on? So I don't think they necessarily were, like, really believed that there's more people in that photo. They're just showing their support for Trump by saying that answer.
And so is that true for most of us, that we consider ourselves maybe more like sports fans than, you know, like reasoned individuals who are looking for truth, that we want to line up with a particular team?
I mean, I think we consider ourselves reasoned individuals that are looking for truth, right? But that's not necessarily how we always behave. And again, it really depends, too. If you're talking politics, like, some people are just not that invested in politics, so they might not be so deeply tied to being a Democrat or a Republican that it's going to exactly play out this way. And in the Trump study, you know, the number of people who said, oh, the Trump's photo has more people in it, it was small. It was significant, but it was small. So, but if you are really deeply tied to your political party or to whatever group that you're in, sometimes you don't engage with information in such a way that it really matters to you if it's true or false.
So I guess at the end of the day, the question is, how do you change somebody's mind? And let's say somebody belongs to a cult that believes the Earth is flat. So even with facts in hand, is it possible to change a person's mind?
No. I mean, yes and no, right? So if you're in a situation where, kind of like what we're talking about, where it's really, really deeply tied to your identity, this cult about the flat Earth is so important to you and it's your whole world, you're probably not going to change their mind. And it's certainly not with evidence. You know, there's definitely been stories of people sort of changing their minds through, like, person-to-person contact. There's a really powerful story a while back about the son of a white supremacist who was part of this white supremacist group, and he went to college, and he talked to all these other people from different religions and different ethnicities, and he sort of slowly saw that he was wrong. But it really, really takes a long time, and it takes, like, sort of interaction with other people. But if it's not something that's, you know, your whole world so deeply tied to your identity, then sure, like, of course facts can make a difference in that case.
Julie, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Julie Beck is Senior Associate Editor at The Atlantic. She joined us to talk about why facts don't always change people's minds.
Coming up, our guest says baby boomers have been a scourge to American prosperity. I'm Rob Ferrat.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.